It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
Welcome to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. This week I'm talking with comedian, filmmaker, and storyteller Lotta Turner, a woman who took an intensely personal journey and turned it into a powerful documentary. Before the sold-out arenas of national fame, there was Rafi May, a kid from Arkansas who discovered that laughter could change everything. He went on to become a breakout star on Last Comic Standing, building a career defined by fearless comedy and nonstop touring. But behind the spotlight, there was a much more complicated story. And in her new documentary, Come What May, Lana pulls back the curtain on Rafi's life, his brilliance, his struggles, and the personal battles that ultimately cut his life short. It's funny, raw, deeply human, and unflinchingly honest. We'll talk about what it takes to tell a story this personal, how she balanced love and truth, and why this film is as much about legacy as it is about loss. Come What May, directed by Dave Gantz and Lana, is composed from rare and raw archival footage of Rafi, along with interviews from his friends and colleagues. And the film will screen in partnership with The Laugh Factory on May 7th at 7 p.m. That's May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Beverly Theater, followed by a live Q&A with Lana and guests. For ticket information, go to TheBeverlyTheater.com. TheBeverlyTheater.com. And for more on the film, go to ComeWhatMayFilm.com. And Lana, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, I was watching the documentary, and what intrigued me about the film, besides the raw nature of it, is how you two were able to stock so much footage along the way in your life, both prior to getting married, after getting married, having kids, etc. Was that just something that the two of you looked on as normal?
You know, it's so funny. You're like the second person who's asked me. Somebody was like, did you just have a camera follow you the whole time? And the answer is no, but we did a couple of pilots. So when I first moved to Los Angeles, like within the first few weeks of being there, I was offered an audition to be on a show that was for Showtime at the time. It was a pilot where they recorded, I think it was like 8 people who live, work, or play on the Sunset Strip. And I went and did the audition and I got cast in it. And so I was recorded like that. Some of that footage was very early on in my life with Rafi because they followed me around for a couple of weeks. And interestingly, David Gantz, who's the director of this film, is the son of the creator and directors of that pilot that I did when I first came to LA.
Small world.
Small world, right? Okay, and then there's more. So we also did another pilot for VH1 where we got more footage taken of us in our lives. There's a kitty cat that's walking around. Sorry. <Hi. We laughs> and like then I like kitty cats too. And then we just also, like, so this is where things really go off the ledge with, like, a regular biopic documentary where you kind of follow, you know, where you just have talking heads and footage. Rafi recorded a documentary we did together, but it was meant to be a weight loss documentary for Rafi, in which we hired somebody for 9 months to follow him and lose weight. And that didn't happen, unfortunately. He would maybe still be here had he followed the original path of that film. Right. But we got a lot of great footage. Definitely he got to tell his story the way that I think he intended.
Well, I wonder why you decide, the film is very personal, and I'm wondering how hard that was to, you're in two roles here. You're a widow and you're a filmmaker. So you're looking at footage that brings you back in time, whereas Dave's looking at it and he sees it more objectively, perhaps professionally, it may be the better term. How did you do that? How are you able to not keep your emotions in check? Because I don't think you can, but you're able to delineate your professional approach on the film to your personal reaction to what you were seeing, which was basically your life.
Another great question. It was really hard. I mean, I just went to the theater for the, we're premiering tomorrow here in LA, and I just was in the theater this morning, and they spot checked the film, meaning they put up a few minutes in different sections just to make sure it's going to play well. Right. And I started to cry. I mean, it is, it's been a really hard thing to go through. It's really important for David to have been involved because I have to be objective. So whenever there was any question of anything, David took the reins and I had to step out of the seat as a director and allow him to like take full liberty with the story because I didn't want to compromise the project by being a subject in the film. When we initially started recording Ralphie, I never wanted to be a subject in this project. I only wanted to record Ralphie and hope that he lost weight and maybe be on the periphery of it. And, but I'm in a lot of the footage. So yeah, I had to have David be the balance in that. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to watch my kids in it. It's hard to see myself in it. There's times when I wish I could go back in time and pull myself out of certain things. Yeah, it's very unusual. And I don't know. It's probably why it's taken nearly a decade to finish is because it was really hard to get through it. So,
but clearly you are the most important thing in his life. Not thing, that sounds so depersonalized. You're the most important person, well, thing and person in his life. Let's put it that way. It really is obvious in the documentary. So you really can't pull yourself out of his story.
Yeah, no, we were together for 17 years and I was with him before he became the Ralphie that everyone knew. And so, yeah. It's true. I'm embedded in his story and as is he in mine. So, yeah.
How important was it when you first met and throughout the years? It's almost a self-fulfilling question, but I do want to ask it because I think it's important. How important was Ralphie's sense of humor as an appealing aspect to your relationship and to you particularly when you met Ralphie and you explained in the documentary how you met? But was the sense of humor, his sense of humor, one of the key factors of cementing that relationship?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love comedy. I mean, and he was hilarious. I mean, he and I got to know each other mostly on the phone. So, I mean, his ability to make me laugh was without a doubt my attraction point to him. Because he was not my typical, I wasn't like, you know, looking to data. 800-pound man. It wasn't like the thing I was seeking out at the time. I mean,
new version of somehow, the couple, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. And to be quite honest, that was not an attraction point. I mean, I always wanted him to be a healthier, thinner person. I'm very, very active. So, yeah. But God, he was so funny. So, yeah, that just is hard not to fall in love with him. He was really funny.
And in the documentary, and you cover a lot of material, but there are scenes of you and Ralphie and with the kids as well. And it's just struck me as I've interviewed a lot of comedians over the years, and there's a lot of comedians that are very funny, but don't have a personal life per se. They're always on stage in a way, figuratively. So they don't really have a family life. They don't have an enduring or stable relationship. It's the nature, I think, partly of the business and partly of the psychology of people who want to be comedians in some cases. But you were able to, and Ralphie was able to balance those two things. In other words, he was hilarious on stage, but at the same time, he was a loving family man.
I don't think you got all the way through the story, right? You got about 45 minutes into it.
I have not watched the whole thing yet. Yeah.
I got
45 minutes into it.
Yeah. I think, I mean, as time went on through our journey together, his career in substance abuse took over from the family part of his ability.
Well,
he wasn't able.
I knew about that, but I mean, initially there was that long period where you had the relationship, you got married, you had kids. And so just to be able to have it for X amount of years versus some comedian, I guess that was my point, as opposed to some comedians that don't have it at all. That kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I like to say, like, I think we were able to have a family because I, as most women or many women, when you have kids, like a lot of times your career might slow way down. And so I definitely have slowed my career down, but I've raised two amazing kids. So I don't know that it was a successful operation of managing careers and kids, to be honest. I think that something's going to give. If you're trying to manage everything perfectly, it's going to be really hard.
I guess what I'm saying is that there at least was the initial stages in several years of where you had a solid relationship and a family. And a lot of comedians, you don't get that at all. So that's where I was trying to go with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see that somewhat. Like, I think it's really hard to balance it all. I mean, look, you're living a nomadic lifestyle. So when the kids were little, I could like, we had probably like the best circumstance for being able to be nomadic. Cause I mean, sadly, and it was awesome. We had a tour bus, right? Like, so that was cool. So we could have like a little house that traveled on the road. It was sad that we had the tour bus. He got that after he had pulmonary embolisms because he wasn't able to fly. So it was kind of like necessity, but it worked out well for meeting him on the road and having kids. And they were little. So little kids are somewhat portable, you know, but as they got older, they want to do their thing as well. So yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
And then also, I was able to, I mean, I had certain advantages. Like, he was very successful, so I could go and open for him. And while I might have been better off, like, doing my own gigs, I wanted to keep us together as a family. So I definitely, like, tried really hard to make sure that he got to see the kids and we all got to see each other. But as you'll see as you go through the story, that was a juggling act.
Right.
Yeah.
His sister in the documentary says that he always had people skills. Do you agree with that assessment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. He was, I mean, he would walk in a room and you'd just be like, oh, yeah. He was a big guy, so you'd see him when he walked in the room. But he had a lot of, he had a charisma for sure.
And that was a natural part of his personality. He grew up that way.
Seems that way, right? Because she's both her and his brother both talk about him as a little boy just, you know, performing, and you know, and maybe that came, I mean, you also saw he had a lot of family trauma, so maybe that was his coping mechanism.
Right.
Yeah,
the sister also was talking about the sweet spot, meaning that he had found that sweet spot in his life, which was that performing on stage in comedy.
Yeah, I mean, he would, at that point in his story, he'd found fame, he had a family, or he had a wife and kids, and his career was on the rise.
Right.
So yeah, he was in the sweet spot, and he imagined just staying in that place, how great that is.
Like,
I think there are some people who manage that, but yeah, it was fleeting, but yeah.
How hard was it to set up? You did interviews with a lot of artists that knew him, Jay Leno and Jay Moore, et cetera. How hard was that setting up those interviews? Were they reluctant at all? Were they willing to cooperate with the documentary?
Oh, they were great. Yeah. Well, we have awesome interviews with terrific people. There were some people that I wish I could have gotten in the film that either weren't available or I just wasn't able to coordinate it. But yeah, but the folks that we got are just, I love our interviews, our interviewees. Yeah. I mean, and Jay Leno, oh my God, like I've gotten to know him a little bit, like through this process. Mm-hmm. He's just like the sweetest human. I mean, I interviewed him. Like, first of all, I walked up to him. I've met him a couple of times. I was like, hey Jay, would you want to do an interview for this documentary? And he said, yeah, give me a call. And I was like, what? And he gave me his phone number. So then I called him and he says, you know, I'm going to have to call you back. I'm under the sink. I'm fixing my plumbing.
Doesn't that sound right?
And I'm like, okay, so the Tonight Show guy is under the sink fixing his plumbing.
Well, yeah.
And then
he was always a regular guy, you know.
He's just a regular dude. Yeah. And so then I'm like, okay, I guess that's not going to happen. Like, I don't think Jay Leno is going to call me back. And then the next day, like, my phone rings and it's him. And I'm in the bathroom. I'm like on the toilet and I see it's Jay Leno and I'm like, I'm not going to not pick up the phone. Okay. And I answer it. And he's like, I book his interview on the, like scheduled him on the toilet. It isn't. So I was like, well, he was fixing his plumbing. I'm sitting on my plumbing.
Exactly right. Yeah. Now Jay has always been that kind of regular guy who doesn't really have that Hollywood vibe, which is probably why he was very successful over all those years performing.
Just so approachable and great. And, you know, like, I don't know, what a blessing to get to know him. You know, and we got Jay Moore's interview, which was critical because Jay was so important for Rafi's career. And that, you know, he was just like a short couple of weeks out of rehab himself. So, like, that was incredible.
The most surprising thing you found from just those interviews of people that talked about Ralphie, was there one thing that came out that you didn't even know, but you were surprised?
Yeah. Especially so there's an interview with a former roommate of ours, like a friend who he became a friend, but he moved in with us and he was obese like Ralphie. His name was Sean Anderson. Sean has since passed away, which is super sad. That's how long it took me to make this documentary of like poor Sean. But like Sean in his interview talked about how he and Rafi were eating buddies.
Oh, okay.
That part really, I didn't know that they waited for me to leave the house so that they could basically like use food as a substance in secrecy, but like together. And that was surprising for me, but yeah. I think other than that, Jamie Masada shared some stories. Jamie was his manager, his first manager, and he's like the most lovely human. And Jamie talked about some like pizzas that were in a hotel room that he found Rafi was eating. And then he also shared a story about at the very end of the film about how Rafi called him at the end of his life and talked to him. And I didn't know that. And so when I heard that, that was pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah. It is interesting how when you start this process of a documentary, even though you were close to Rafi clearly and the most important person to him, you find out things you didn't know, that all of a sudden a friend or colleague mentioned something that, all right, that's interesting.
Well, when he passed away, I found out a lot of things, both good and bad, that I didn't know. Yeah. Because there was a lot. He had his secrets for sure that I never knew our entire marriage. So I definitely had to unwind that, which is part of the fascination of doing this film, because I could kind of like unbox things and figure out what had happened. And yeah, and look at myself in that too, because I have my own role to play. So
did you keep secrets from him?
No.
I don't think so, but
no, I can answer that instantly. And no, I don't keep secrets from people. You can ask me anything.
I want to mention again to our audience, Come What May, will screen in partnership with the Laugh Factory on May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Beverly Theater. We'll mention a couple more times, especially at the end, for details. But when you decided to make this documentary, was it a combination of resolving something within you and also to honor Ralphie? In other words, what was the motivation for going through this process, which had to be painful?
Boy, I kind of had to. He left behind 9 months of footage that started when we start the film. It starts with "Tell my story, be honest, good or bad. I don't give a shit," you know. And I was like, I kind of have a responsibility to it and to his fans. And I mean, his story, it's not a typical biopic. I mean, it's an addiction story and there's a gift in that. So the whole way through, I've felt like it's really important for me to share it. I think it can help other people. Selfishly, I think it can help my children because addiction is a family cycle. So if my children are very in touch with what happened in their father's situation, like in his life, as opposed to just hearing it from me, they can see it and really relive it through this film. And as painful as that is, I'm hoping that it derails future addiction problems or codependency problems that probably exist inside my kids too. So yeah. There's a barrage of reasons for doing this thing. I mean, I haven't made a dime. It's only cost me money. I don't know if I'll ever make back what I put into it, but I certainly hope at least break even on it. Like, that would be really nice. It's definitely been a labor of love. Yeah. So,
Have you calculated the amount of we know the effort, but the amount of time involved in producing and directing this documentary and putting it all together. Are we talking years? And how many years do you think over when you first
years.
Thought? Yeah, when you first thought of it.
I have been my own legal team, so I had to do all the legal legwork on it, which was like an insane. I mean, I had to learn about licensing. I had to learn about fair use. I mean, I never did anything like this before, so. I mean, the learning curve in that alone was, there's been a lot of mistakes made that I had to go back in and unwind, and contracts that I mean, I'm not legally smart, so I had to figure this stuff out. So that alone was its own thing. But I mean, I didn't know color, sound mastering, and the edit alone took so much time. So, and money. And then while I was making the film, I had to generate the money to do the film. So that process also, you know, that takes time.
Where did you go? Where do you get the strength to do all that? I'm very impressed by the fact that you're able to do this, because you're dealing with an emotionally laden subject, and at the same time, it's a business in a way, because you don't want to lose money, as you say, you're fronting a lot of the money, but you're able to you took all of it on yourself in terms of researching the legal aspects of it, the technical filmmaking aspects of it, or tape aspects of it, or in this case, digital aspects of it, the marketing of it, the releases that you have to get from people that you talk to and interview, et cetera. So you have all that going on. That requires a certain amount of focus and strength to do all that.
I mean, I want to answer and be like, I'm a badass.
No, go ahead and tell me.
It took its toll on many things. Like, I mean, it's been so much time. Probably the hardest thing. I have a boyfriend that helped me, believe it or not. And that's really hard for him.
I bet.
He's a saint. Yeah. Cause he's technically savvy. So he's been involved at least the last couple of years in helping me bring it across the finish line. And that was not easy for him. So, I mean, there's like a lot of layers to that question. I just think it's really important to finish it. I think Ralphie isn't gone yet. I'm not super spiritual, but I definitely think he's sticking around. This was his career was the most important thing. And I don't know. I feel like he's going to be there at the screening feel like he'll be there at the premiere. I just can't imagine that. I mean, this was important to him, important enough that he spent 9 months filming it. So as his partner of 17 years and the executrix, which I like to say that word because it's sexier than executor, but I'm the executrix of his estate. So it's been both, you know, it's hard because he and I didn't end on good terms. Like we were separated at the end of his life. So having to go and understand that I have a responsibility to somebody that also didn't treat me all that great at the very end was also a whole nother thing to overcome. So, hey, is this therapy? Are we doing a therapy session here? Because we can really unpack.
It helped you and helped me.
Yeah. We can do some deep breathing.
Yeah. Well, look at all those obstacles. You just laid them all out. That was the point I was making earlier. It takes a certain amount of strength to deal with all that, because you've got financial obligation and commitments. You've got the exec, you'll have to say it because I'll trip over it because of politics.
Executrix.
Thank you. That one as well. And then you've got the boyfriend who has to be involved, and there's an emotional aspect of that, but he knows his technical stuff. And then you've got all these people that have agreed to be in the film that you ask, and you're not sure they're going to do it, but they are doing it. And that's a lot of stuff to put on your shoulders. So who do you vent to besides me?
you. Let's make this a regular thing.
Sure. Call me anytime. It's fine.
I did a lot of therapy. I hike a lot. I walk a lot and I lift heavy weight whenever I can. I just like try to take it out in healthier ways. And I mean, I don't know. I think my burden is, weird as it might be, is certainly not like some other people. I have this like moment in my life that I had in my 20s when I went to India, and I saw this woman. This is, I'm going to try and keep the story a little on the shorter side because it's kind of a long story. But in this one town, there was this woman who was begging, and she didn't have a nose. Like, she literally didn't, like, there was just two holes in her head, and this whole cartilage part was missing. And I can't imagine my life will ever be as hard as hers, mm-hmm. no matter what. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I have it that bad. I think I've been through some stuff. Right. I've had to cut a film about my deceased husband, who was definitely a hard time when going through the addiction and everything, and raised two kids by myself and try and stay in my house and everything else that, you know, definitely is like, oh, that's not easy, but I have a nose. See?
And you also have perspective too.
Yeah, that was really good for me to see. I mean, what it really means to have a hard life.
Yeah.
And she was one of many people that I saw during that time.
Right.
So yeah, as far as human condition goes, I've never been hungry.
Very, again,
not without choosing to fast or some stupid LA diet trend, right? Then I've been, oh my God, I'm so hungry. I haven't eaten for 24 hours.
I get it. And that's the perspective. That's why it's great that you have that, which allows you to function. And frankly, too, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people over the years, guests on the show and stuff. You don't strike me as being particularly neurotic or Hollywood neurotic. You seem to be a fairly stable person, which is pretty good considering everything you're dealing with.
I hope so. I'm sure I'm a little neurotic.
Okay, I'll give you a little bit. So before I let you go, what would you like people to get or take away from watching Come What May, which again is at the Laugh Factory, or in partnership with the Laugh Factory, on May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Beverly Theater here in Las Vegas?
Boy, that's a layered question too, because I think everyone's going to get their own thing from it. I kind of want to answer that as if I was answering on behalf of Ralphie. So I think he would say that he always wanted to help people, whether it be through making them laugh or some act of kindness, the true Ralphie, not the one that was hooked on opioids at the end of his life that was fully destructive, but the person that I met early on and fell in love with, he had a big heart and he wanted to make sure that people left his space feeling like they learned something or they're better for it. And he even talked about wanting to have a career in politics. Like, he wanted to change things in the world. And so if he can help someone else who may be going through an addiction problem and they have children that need them, or somebody like me who might be going through a codependency problem, if they see this film and it helps them through that, then cool. You know, that's a gift. And then also the more than anything else, they leave this film and they go, you know what? I want to laugh. Mm-hmm. And they pull up the content, his stand up. Maybe they find my stand up, whatever it is. And it leads them back to laughter and joy. That was always something that he and I together always wanted to spread. So there are a lot of moments of laughter in the film. And so you could take that away. You can go and revel in the enjoyment of just pure laughter. And then you can also leave and go, you know, there's a cautionary tale in this. And I learned something.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been comedian, filmmaker, and storyteller Lana Turner, whose new documentary, Come What May, will screen in partnership with the Laugh Factory on May 7th at 7 p.m. at the Beverly Theater, followed by a live Q&A with Lana and guests. And for ticket information, go to thebeverlytheater.com, thebeverlytheater.com. And for more on the film, go to comewhatmayfilm.com, comewhatmayfilm.com. And Lana, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Be Las Vegas. Anything you want us to be. Bring us your fantasy. LV. When you